Inflation has been a buzzword this fall, and here in the UK, we could be looking at a 5% rate sooner than we thought. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. That is the warning this morning from the Bank of England's new chief economist, Hugh Pill. He told the Financial Times he would not be shocked to see inflation at or around 5% in the months ahead. And given the bank's 2% inflation target, he contends this is a very uncomfortable place for the BOE to be. He says the option to raise interest rates at the bank's next meeting on November 4th is still very much in play. Michael Hewson, chief markets analyst at CMC Markets, gives us his view on whether rates will imminently rise.
I think it's quite likely we'll see an interest rate increase, a modest one, by the end of this year. Whether it's November or not, I think is neither here nor there. I think we will get one simply on the basis that the Bank of England have more or less painted themselves into a corner. What with the comments from Andrew Bailey about anchoring consumer inflation expectations. So I think as long as they manage it and do a modest 0.15% increase and push them back to 0.25%, it should be eminently manageable. I think what they need to guard against is this expectation that somehow interest rates or base rates will be at 1% by the end of next year, because I think that's not credible.
The thing is, I think for people looking at the headlines this morning, seeing that the Bank of England's chief economist says that inflation could get to 5% in the next few months, that'll be fairly surprising, I think. You know, policymakers insisted that this inflation was temporary, transitory, once economies got back to normal, but it hasn't. So what's happened here?
In a word, supply chains. I think there was an underestimation of how much damage was done to the supply of labor. Obviously, this is not just a localized problem, it's a global problem. You've got semiconductor shortages, you've got supply chain disruptions, you've got labor shortages. And an awful lot of this was brought about as a consequence of some major shutdowns. But you've also got pent-up demand. The government support packages that were brought in, which cushioned consumers from the impact of the pandemic, has meant that consumers now have an awful lot more savings than would have been the case if governments hadn't intervened. And unfortunately, there's too much demand and not enough supply, and that's helping to drive prices higher. So what was likely or expected to be a temporary problem is now likely to persist.
The other interesting part of this too, Michael, is that if the Bank of England does raise interest rates in November, they're not usually the ones that lead these big global changes in monetary policy positions, are they? If they do move them higher, then what does that mean for the Fed? Does it make the Fed look like it's even more on its back foot as well?
I mean, this is a conversation that people are having right now. There is this school of thought that says the Fed is behind the curve. And I think the Federal Reserve is very much behind the curve. But I think because they've got a dual mandate, which means they have to target the labor market as opposed to, say, the Bank of England and all of the other central banks, that's allowed them to fall a little bit behind where inflation is currently running at. You extrapolate that forward, I think what you could find is that the Federal Reserve may well have to play catch up if the Bank of England raises rates by the end of this year. So absolutely, I think there is a school of thought that the Fed is being criticized for being behind the curve, and the Bank of England is being criticized for potentially a policy mistake for being ahead of the curve.
Another round of heavily watched central bank policy action. Michael Hewson, market analyst at CMC Markets. Thanks for your time.
Life is never simple, Victoria.
Well, those supply chain problems that Michael mentioned there stunted business activity across the Eurozone this month. Fresh figures this morning show activity declined to a six-month low. As we check the numbers, though, that hasn't dampened market sentiment much. Stock benchmarks across Europe are up in the 0.4% to 1% range. And shares of indebted Chinese property developer Evergrande closed up 4.2% today in Hong Kong. That's after reports it made a crucial and overdue $83 million interest payment to foreign bondholders. That's day before the deadline, and it staves off default. Well, as we've been discussing this morning, supply chain problems have kept business owners of all kinds on their toes this year. Now another potential disaster is lurking in one of the world's busiest shipping lanes, where a marooned tanker is rusting away. The BBC's Ed Butler has that story.
Picture the scene, a massive oil tanker moored out at sea. It's loaded with hundreds of tons of crude oil. It hasn't moved in years. It can't. The engines have failed. The hull is now rusting, and it's pounded by waves. For the handful of crew members still on board battling to keep the ship afloat, things are getting desperate.
The ship moves forward each day towards the worst. science, mind, logic, experience, all confirm that disaster is imminent. But when it will exactly happen, Allah only knows.
These panic-stricken words were written by the ship's chief engineer in a leaked report last year. The boat, the FSO Safa, is sitting in the Red Sea, 100 kilometres off the coast of Yemen. Hua Nakat is the executive director of Greenpeace for the Middle East and North Africa.
It's a ticking time bomb. The greatest risk is we could have at any time a leak or an explosion, which would cause a major environmental, economical and humanitarian disaster.
Last year, there was a leak in the ship's engine room. A corroded pipe had burst and was spewing in seawater. Makeshift repairs did partially patch that up, but only partially. No one thinks a massive oil spill can be prevented in the long term. With more than 1 million barrels on board, that would make this the biggest oil spill in history. Ben Hun is a researcher at Stanford University. He's helped to write a report on the likely impact of a potential spill.
I think the larger issue is that the ports will be closed just because of the oil that's the fire hazard of the oil.
In a busy shipping route, an oil spill on this scale could have severe economic impacts. So why isn't more being done? The simple answer would be to drain the 1.1 million barrels of crude oil that are on the ship. The problem is, though, no one can agree who owns it. Nominally, it's the property of the Saudi-backed Yemeni government. But both the ship and its multi-million dollar cargo are controlled by Houthi rebels at the moment. This political wrangling has left the Yemeni relief effort, the ecology of the Red Sea, and, you could argue, one of the world's most important shipping lanes in limbo. I'm the BBC's Ed Butler for Marketplace.
And here in London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.